All right, let's get started. I want to welcome you all today to session two. This is, of course, a three-part series, as I get things settled on my phone here. Three-part series. I want to start today with a recommendation, and that is this, that as we study church history, as we learn more about it, that we do our best to try to avoid trying to find ourselves in the history or trying to justify our own beliefs all the time and feel like we have to do that. You know, I think as we study, certainly in my experience has been as I've learned and really done deep dives, that there have been things in the history of the church that have disappointed me and things that even in the early church I'll disagree with. There would be some theological things. So as I speak and mention theological beliefs, not necessarily what I believe in some cases. I just want to try to convey the history as I've learned it. But, you know, the church did a lot of things right in the early church, but they didn't do everything right. So just as a way of warning for us, I think, as we look at the early church, let's keep the things that are good and always weigh things against the scriptures. And I think that's the way we stay out of trouble. You know, as by example, remember last week I mentioned that in the fourth century, the church really struggled with what happens if we sin after baptism? And that was a big debate. And I think that was an example of where I thought the church didn't quite have that right. And particularly when it led to delaying baptism until your deathbed. It's like, I don't think that was right. So it's just an example of that. But if we stick with the scriptures and take those things that are good, those things that are in accordance with scriptures, I think that can be really valuable for us. Okay, now we don't need to do too much, I don't think, theological discernment today because the topic of today is persecution. So I hope you find this interesting, enjoyable, humbling. I've got some stories to tell. It's a colorful history, and it's a sad history in many ways, but yeah, there's much to be learned from it. You know, Christians were persecuted for various reasons. We know that the very earliest church centered in Jerusalem were persecuted by the Jewish authorities. The Jewish authorities were concerned about Roman rule. They were concerned about the wrath of God. They were afraid if the Christian movement continues to grow, that God would punish them. But, you know, as the church spread to the Gentiles, at some point, persecution began with Roman authorities. The Romans grew increasingly suspicious of the Christians as initially, they were not very well known by Romans, and so there were rumors that spread around. After all, Christians met in secret, worshiped one God, and this God was invisible after all, which made it hard, I think challenging, for them to be understood. And Christians, as we're going to see examples today, refused to worship the emperor, refused to burn incense to images of the emperor, things like that. That got many of them in Christians in trouble during their time. Okay, now this idea of this practice that was widespread of burning incense to the emperor was something that the Jews have long been exempt from. It's because the Romans respected the Jewish religion. After all, the God of Israel is an ancient religion. Of course, as I say, that's kind of strange, but their scriptures were ancient and their practices were ancient. And the Romans respected ancient religion. And so they had respect for the Jews and their religion. And they come to realize that, you know, when the Jews refused to burn incense to the image of the emperor, the Romans began to realize that it wasn't that they were not patriotic. It was because of their deep convictions. And so they didn't fear that by not doing that, they meant an insurrection. And so they gave the Jews a pass. Initially, the Christians, being closely associated with the Jews, got a pass too. But before long, they lost their free ticket there. So the Romans began to enact on that. When we look at the first couple of centuries of the church, the persecution was sporadic for the most part. The first century, the worst instance locally of persecution, it happened in Rome. It happened in 64 AD. This was the year of the great fire of Rome that destroyed much of the city. Of course, the emperor at this time was Nero, very infamous Nero. Nero came to power 10 years prior to this in 54. He came to power because his mother, Agrippina, murdered Nero's adopted father. It wasn't his biological father, but this was Caligula. And she murdered him, but you know, Nero proved to not be too thankful for that, because indeed Nero murdered Agrippina. The story of that, very briefly, is kind of an interesting one. Agrippina was going to an event that required her to cross a bay on a boat. And Nero arranged for that boat to suddenly sink in the middle of the bay. Now, Agrippina managed to swim to shore and survived. Well, when Nero found out that Agrippina survived, he got very nervous because he was afraid of Agrippina. She had a lot of power in her own right. And he feared that she was going to spread rumors and that Nero tried to kill me and that might backfire. So he dispatched what amounted to an assassin, a member of his armed forces, that killed her with a sword. So Nero was an interesting character. You know, he was initially very popular. I mean, in fact, when he began his reign, the people of Rome adored him. They thought he was young. He was charismatic. He was certainly strange in a lot of ways. Initially, he was thought very positively, but it didn't take too long for the Romans to not like him anymore. You know, he was incredibly narcissistic. He considered himself a great poet, a great actor, a great painter, in fact, an artist. But the thing was, is he expected everyone around him to think of him the same way. And you better consider him a great actor and a great poet, or else. And he would be seen out in the city of Rome complaining about the city of Rome. Nero would talk about how he didn't like this building. He didn't like the way this street went. He didn't like the layout. He didn't like how these buildings were close together. He just seemed very unhappy and unsatisfied with the city of Rome. And so in AD 64, convenient or not convenient, Nero left the city and he was enjoying himself at his seaside villa in Antium, which is, if you were driving in a car, it's about 45 minutes southwest of Rome. There was a royal palace there. He was there when the fire broke out in the city of Rome. We know that the fire began somewhere around the merchant areas at the Circus Maximus in Rome. And it spread very quickly. Rome at the time, of course, the buildings were very close together. And so the fire spread uncontrolled. They couldn't put it out. And it almost completely destroyed everywhere in the city. Well, Nero was initially blamed. The people blamed Nero. He was at this point becoming unpopular. And after all, he complained about the city. They knew it. They heard him complain. And the thought was, well, he burned the city down so that he can rebuild it the way he likes it. Well, this put Nero in a lot of hot water. He didn't like this. He had to have a scapegoat. So Nero decided to blame the Christians and said, the Christians did it. Christians set the city on fire. Rome at that time was made up of 12 sections. 10 of the 12 sections were completely destroyed. It didn't help the Christians' case that the two sections of the city that didn't burn was largely where the Christians lived. So that added to the suspicion that maybe the Christians were somehow responsible for the fire. And the people did start to believe that the Christians burned the city. The truth is, no one really knows how the fire got started. We still don't know exactly how the fire got started. Nero was cruel in the way he dealt with Christians at this time, trying to retaliate for the Christians for supposedly burning the city. And we have some remarkable accounts of this. Tacitus. Tacitus was a politician in Rome. He survived the fire. We think of him as a historian because remarkably, particularly for his time, he wrote a lot about what was happening at that time, wrote a lot about the history of Rome, things like that. So we have some of his writings. I want to read to you what Tacitus wrote. He said, in spite of every human effort of the emperor's largesse and of the sacrifices made to the deities, nothing sufficed to allay suspicion nor to destroy the opinion that the fire had been ordered. Therefore, in order to destroy this rumor, Nero blamed the Christians, who are hated for their abominations. Tacitus was not a fan of Christians. And punished them with refined cruelty. Thus, first, those who confessed that they were indeed Christians were arrested, and on the basis of their testimony, a great number were condemned, although not so much for the fire itself as for their hatred for humankind. Strong words about Christians. And Nero himself was especially cruel in how he tortured Christians, how he murdered Christians. Tacitus writes about that as well. He says, before killing the Christians, Nero used them to amuse the people. Some were dressed in furs to be killed by dogs. Others were crucified, and still others were set on fire early in the night so that they might illuminate it. Nero opened his own gardens for these shows. I lost my place. Oh, and in the circus, he himself became a spectacle. For he mingled with the people dressed as a charioteer, or he rode around in his chariot, and all of this aroused the mercy of the people, even against these culprits who deserved an exemplary punishment. For it was clear that they were not being destroyed for the common good, but rather to satisfy the cruelty of one person. So Nero was ruthless against the Christians at this time. But you know, this persecution of the Christians in Rome, it was a local affair. It really didn't spread outside of the city itself as bad as it was. We have good sources to believe that this is when Paul was killed. He was imprisoned for the second time in Rome and murdered after this time. They got caught up in this after the fire. And we have pretty good sources to suggest that Peter was also killed at this time in Rome. There is one source. It dates from the late 2nd century. It's an apocryphal work. The apocryphal work of Peter. There's a work from the late 2nd century. I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but it was written about Peter, and in that source, it said that Peter was crucified upside down. Now, if you look at the timing, that's a pretty late source. So we don't know for sure, but that's where that comes from. If you've heard that before, it comes from the late second century. We really don't see any empire-wide systematic persecution until the third century. In the mid-third century, around 250, I'll talk a little bit about that later, but through most of the time of the early church, it was sporadic. It was tended to be localized. It was real. I'm not trying to overly minimize it, but you probably heard or had this sense or heard from people that like, oh, the early church was always under persecution. It was terrible. Everybody was dying all the time. It wasn't really like that. We're going to talk a little bit about what it was really like. And the best source to really understand what was the policy of the Roman authorities towards Christians in the early church really was articulated by Trajan. Trajan was the emperor at the very end of the first century in the 90s, and he was having a letter correspondence between the governor of Bithynia. Bithynia is a northern province of Turkey. And in Bithynia, the governor's name was Pliny the Younger. And he became exasperated because he started noticing that the number of Christians in his area, it keeps growing and growing and growing. This is the end of the first century, okay? And all of a sudden, these pagan temples, there's not very many people going to them anymore. And it was disrupting commerce because the farmers and merchants who would sell animals for animal sacrifices to pagan gods were losing money. And Pliny's like, what do I do with these Christians? Should I just kill them all? What should I do? So he writes a letter to Trajan, who's the emperor, asking Trajan, what should I do with the Christians? And Trajan writes him a letter back. We still have that. And it's remarkable because what Trajan told Pliny the Younger was he said explicitly, don't go after the Christians. He said, don't go seek them out. Don't go door to door. But what he did say is that if someone is accused of being a Christian, you got to take that person out in public, force them to recant of their faith, and they need to sacrifice to the pagan gods. And by the way, you got to burn incense to the image of the emperor. But if they're not willing to do that, then you can kill them or imprison them or whatever you want to do, basically. That really set the tone for much of the early church history. In some ways, it's a blessing, right? Because for much of the early church, we didn't have Roman soldiers going door to door looking for Christians. That did happen. That happened in the 3rd century, early 4th century. But most of the history wasn't like that. But it was cruel in another way, because as a Christian, you always kind of live in fear, because Christianity was not legal, and all it took was someone to accuse you of being a Christian. Now try to put yourself in their shoes. So we're called to go out and spread the gospel, and these early Christians would often go to their places of work or their family and invite them to their secret meetings. Well, what if they say they don't want to come? And what if they're so put off by you being a Christian that they go and accuse you to the Roman authorities? Now that's where you get persecuted. And that's scary because you don't know if it's going to be a family member, it's going to be a coworker. You just don't know. And I think that's the cruel part of it in my own mind. And so Christians often lived in fear. And many did die. And many were tortured because they were accused and refused to recant. So, one example of this that I did want to talk about is a young woman named Perpetua. Perpetua, this is in the year 202 in Carthage, North Africa. It's where modern-day Tunisia is today. She was a remarkable young woman. She had just recently given birth to a baby girl. And she became a Christian, along with her slave. She had a slave in the family. Her name was Felicitas. And these two young women became Christians, but they were catechumenates. Remember, we talked about that last week. That means they were in that period of instruction of the church before baptism, so they had not yet been baptized. And someone accused Perpetua of being a Christian. And she was brought before the authorities. Perpetua refused to recant of her faith, so they ordered her to die in the arena by wild animal. So they put her in prison, waiting on her day to die. And it's quite remarkable of a story. She wrote a diary. We have that diary today. Wow. And it's particularly remarkable because it is the earliest writing that we have from a Christian woman. We have nothing earlier than Perpetua. And she wrote about her experience in the prison while she waited her turn in the arena. Felicitas, the slave that was with her, in prison with her also, was very pregnant. And while they waited in prison, she gave birth to a baby. And in fact, we know from Perpetua's diary that that baby was handed off to a Christian woman outside and raised her, was going to raise her. So that could have been, I don't know the rest of that story, but wow. An eyewitness to the day that they were martyred in the arena said that it was remarkable that how they walked in, because they had a look and a stance of joy. Most people would walk into the arena, obviously fearful, obviously downcast, but these two women walked in with their head up, head held high. Their hair was pinned up in a bow, kind of a bun. That was typical of that time. Women at that time didn't wear their hair down. Typically, that was done when that signified mourning. So if you had someone who died in your family, you would wear your hair down as a sign of mourning. But back then, other than that, women always wore their hair up. These women went into that arena with the hair up, which sent a signal that this is not my day of mourning. In fact, when they released the wild animals on these women, The woman, the animal they released, kind of odd. It was a heifer, type of a female cow, but it was described as a mad heifer. This heifer came up, knocked these women down, injured them, didn't kill them. And Perpetua, when she stood back up, her hair had fallen. And she managed to cry out to the crowd for a pin. And she pinned her hair back up while she was laying there injured. She would not make that day a joy. That would not be a day of mourning. That was a day of joy for her, as she knew that she was honored to be a martyr and to see her Lord. Ultimately, the animals actually didn't kill the women. They were killed by a sword. They had to dispatch a soldier to kill them because the animals lost interest. They did spring a leopard out on. I'm sorry, this is a little gory, but you might find this interesting. There was a young man with them in the arena that was killed by the leopard, didn't strike the women, but they were killed by the sword. So that's an example of a catechumenate. That's an example of someone who was accused, who refused to recant. But as I talked about the general rule for most of the early church, there were exceptions to this rule, as there typically are. I'll give you one example of an exception in the early 4th century. Caesar Licinius had issued an order to the armies out in the field. He was Caesar of kind of the eastern portion of the empire at that time, that the commanders were to seek out and find all the Christians in their ranks and expel them from the army and otherwise try to force them to recant. So he sent this order out to the army out in the field. It was in the wintertime, and there was one such army out in the field. The commander did just that. He was able to, through inquiries, find 40 Christians in his ranks. And so he separated them out. It was very cold outside. He had these 40 soldiers strip of their clothes and had them walk out onto a frozen lake naked. And then he had his men build bonfires on the shore and cook big pots of stew and make it obvious. And he called out to these 40 men who were shivering on the ice and said, if you will recant of your faith, you can come over here, you can warm yourself by the fire, you can have some stew, and you can rejoin the army. So these 40 men hovering together out there in the cold did their best to encourage each other, to keep the faith, to not deny their Lord. And after a period of time, one of them couldn't take it anymore and broke. And he ran over, he recanted of his faith in Christ, and he began to warm himself by the fire and put his clothes back on. After that, there was a guard that was overlooking the men over on the ice, was so moved by the devotion of these men that he took his own clothes off and he ran out there and joined these men on the ice. And so there were 40 again. I wish I had a good ending of this story, because it's not a good ending. These 40 men, they died, every one of them. They refused to recant of their faith in Jesus Christ. Empire-wide persecution, we first see that in the 3rd century. In the year 250, Emperor Decius issued an edict. And this edict was that all people in the empire are required to make sacrifices to pagan gods, to burn incense to the emperor. Why did he order this? We haven't seen this in hundreds of years. There were localized, if you're accused and you recant, you have to burn incense. But it wasn't systematically everybody in the empire has to do this. The reason is because this is 250. The empire was in obvious decline by then. In fact, for about 150 years. If you look at the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, didn't fall in a day. And you really see the empire reach a peak with Trajan. I mentioned Trajan earlier. This is around the year 100. So for about 150 years until we get to Decius, it's been in steady decline. economically, chiefly. We see this. We've got records of outlays and inlays of cash and things like that throughout the Roman Empire was contracting over that period of time. One, I think, the most interesting evidence of this, we have archaeological evidence of Roman coinage. And up until the year 100, which is really its peak of the empire, for the previous 600 years, now that goes all the way previous to the empire is the Roman Republic days, right? But for 600 years, the Roman coins were pure silver. And then after the year 100, we have all these archaeological coins. Steadily, you can trace it out. Seemed like every 10 or 15 years, there's less and less silver. They started mixing the metals. It's another evidence. By the time you get to 250, there was no silver, none in the coins. So they were in decline, and Decius comes to power. Well, what did he do? He blamed the Christians. He said, well, the obvious reason for our decline is because there's fewer people worshiping the pagan gods, the ancient gods, right, according to their society. And so he said, issued this edict. Well, of course, the Jews were still exempt. But everyone, Christians, not Christians, didn't matter. Everyone had to do it. And then if you do it, you get a certificate that proves that you did it. So if you're ever questioned, hey, did you burn incense to the emperor? You could pull out your certificate and prove that, yes, I did. And then the soldiers would pass you by. The certificate had a name. It was called a libellus. I'm giving an example. We still have some of these. It's quite remarkable. You can read them online. There's all kinds of them you can read online. I'm going to read one of them here just to give you an example of what the certificate said. So here's one. It says, to the officers in charge of the sacrifices of the village of Alexander's Isle, from Aurelius Diogenes, the son of Tibetus of the village of Alexander's Isle, aged about 72 with a scar on his right eyebrow. I have always, they obviously didn't have driver's license or so it's like, yeah, to describe him as scars so that you can prove that it was him, you know. With a scar on his right eyebrow, I have always sacrificed to the gods, and now in your presence, according to the commands, I have sacrificed and made a libation and tasted of the victims, meaning that they ate the sacrifice. I've tasted the victims, and I desire you to subscribe. Fare you well. So there's an example of a real libellus, what it said, and you'd keep this as proof that you did do this. And, of course, there were many Christians who did do this, sadly, but many did not. Many held strong to their faith and refused to do that type of thing. It did lead to widespread arrests, imprisonments, tortures, martyrs, things like that. It was a very difficult time. Fortunately for Decius, this persecution only lasted 18 months. Thank God. And as bad as it was, and it only ended because Decius died. But sprang up again. So that was in 250, only lasted 18 months. In 257, Emperor Valerian issued a similar edict. So it started all over again. This time it lasted 3 years. And then after the Valerian persecutions, the church went through this long 40-year period of peace. Really interesting. In fact, quite remarkable. A peace like they'd never experienced before. So right on the heels of this systematic persecution, they had peace. In fact, Eusebius, writing toward the end of this period, referred to it as the little piece of the church. That was the phrase he would use to describe this period. Let me give you just a couple of examples of what this peace was like. It was issued by an edict called the Edict of Toleration by Valerian's son. So when Valerian died, his son Gallienus issued the edict, and it halted persecutions across the empire against Christians. Christians, in fact, began to build places of worship. So they started building churches. They weren't elaborate. They didn't have government funding. It wasn't like Constantine. Those became really elaborate. This is before that, right? But they would build what they can. And also Christian cemeteries. So where there were cemeteries, where there was a huge number of Christians in there, the state began to give that cemetery property to the church and say, you own that. That's yours. And that was significant to the Christians. And so 40 years of peace. Sadly, it ended in the worst persecution, and that was Diocletian. So just a few years prior to Diocletian, the 40 years of peace ended. The Diocletian persecution began in 303, and it was the most severe. It lasted the longest. It was about 7 years long. And very similar to the previous ones with Decius and Valerian, there's a lot of similarity. This one, of course, was longer. It was more severe. But this one had a new element to it. Diocletian had this idea that, you know, we could wipe out the Christians if we can just confiscate and destroy their scriptures, because they keep talking about scriptures all the time. And so the soldier would go up to an elder, a bishop, a presbyter, and demand hand over the scriptures. Of course, they would kill them too, but they would make them hand over the scriptures. And many of them did to try to avoid persecution. And so we did lose a lot of our early scripture through that. There were many martyrs at this time and many people imprisoned. You know, it's helpful, I think, and this is the thing that initially trips me up and I think I still wonder about is, you know, as a Christian today, I wonder why were Christians so hated? You know, I mean, our message is the gospel of peace, of joy, of the Lord and salvation, God's redemptive plan, all this stuff, the gospel. Why is it that Christians were persecuted in the first place? And it's certainly true that in the early church, Christians were accused of various things. Usually the accusations weren't fair, but they were accusations against Christians. So let's talk about some of those accusations. What were these accusations that led to persecution? Well, first of all, Christians were accused of being cannibals. And that's maybe understandable when Christians would talk about eating flesh of their Lord, drinking blood. Christians were also caught rescuing babies that were left out to die for exposure. You know, in the Roman Empire this time, this is heartbreaking, but it was acceptable socially if you had a baby and didn't want it. What Romans would do is they would undress the baby and then they would leave it on a rock to die. Just lay there until it died of exposure. And that was quite common in these first centuries of the church. Well, the Christians would go see these babies and rescue them because they valued life. But in the eyes of Romans, when they would see Christians rescuing these babies and they hear about them eating flesh and blood in these secret meetings in the morning, they put those together and thought that they were eating babies. And so there were accusations. You can have rumors can spread. You hear these things. And they said, well, they're cannibals. That was an accusation. They're also accused of disrupting business. We know that. We talked about Bithynia and Pliny the Younger. But also right in Scripture, Acts 19, right? We learn about in Ephesus with the loss of the silversmiths and the businesses with the cult of Diana and all that. So the Romans didn't like this, you know, all the people becoming Christians and it's disrupting business. So that was an accusation. They saw that as a negative. Christians were accused of gross immorality, including incest. That may be understandable when Christians go around calling each other brothers and sisters when they weren't related to each other. That was odd to the Romans. Christians gave each other holy kisses. And they talked about going to a love feast. It just didn't sound right to the Roman. And so they thought that there was gross immorality at these meetings. Now, here's one that's going to be surprising to you. Christians were accused of being anti-family. What? Anti-family. That's right. And that's because Christians were willing to forsake their father and their mother and their brothers and their sisters for their faith in Christ. And that happened a lot, where one would become a Christian and their family would disown them. And they were willing to forsake their family for their faith. And so the Romans accused them of being anti-family. For people who would leave babies out to die, it's kind of hard to take that. But yeah, that was an accusation. Young Perpetua, we're learning about earlier, in her diary, she wrote about her father, who would come to her while she was in prison, and he would plead with her to recant of her faith, save herself. In fact, one of the writings in her diary, her father said this. He said, "Don't forget me. Don't forget your mother. Don't forsake your sisters. What about your infant child?" Remember, she had just given birth to a child. And her father is saying, "Don't forget about us. You're killing yourself, and you don't care about us." To Perpetua, she was unwilling to deny her Lord. And the accusation that's probably most surprising of all is Christians were accused of atheism. After all, they worshiped one God, which was unusual at that time. But this God was invisible, which made it also seem a little odd to the Romans. And so they just said, "Well, you're atheist." Polycarp was a martyr, bishop of Smyrna. He was burned at the stake in a stadium. And when they tied him to the stake, and before they lit the flames, lit the fire, the proconsul walked up to him while he was on the stake and said to him, he said, "Look, if you would just say, 'Away with the atheist,' I'll let you down and I'll let you live." And of course, by saying that, the proconsul is saying, "Christian." He said, "If you'll say, 'Away with the atheist,' I'll let you go." Well, Polycarp, maintaining his wit all the way to the end, he lifted his arm and he pointed to the crowd and he said, "Away with the atheist." The proconsul didn't think that was very funny. And so they lit the flames and he died. Christians were accused of having a novel religion, accused of novelty. Now, that's just because the Romans considered the Christian faith a new religion. And remember, they valued things that were ancient. Of course, we look at our faith and say, "Well, our faith is ancient." But to the Romans, it didn't look like that. It looked, from the outside, it looked like a new religion. And so it was not thought of very well that you would create a religion. You just don't do that. Instead, they look for the ancient gods. And so that was an accusation. They were accused of being not patriotic. And it's not that they weren't. It's just that it's understandable that they would be accused of that, because after all, Christians wouldn't attend public events. They didn't attend the arenas as spectators. They didn't attend festivals. And the reason for it is because there was so much immorality. There were people getting killed, people getting tortured. There were abundant practices of pagan sacrifices and burning incense to emperor. Well, the Christians weren't going to be a part of that, so they didn't go. Well, the Romans looked at that and said, "Well, you're just not patriotic." And so they were accused of not being patriotic. And related to that is being accused of not willing to burn incense to the emperor. They thought that was a lack of patriotism too, but for obvious reasons, we only worship one God. But I saved my favorite accusation for the last one, because the Christians were also widely accused of causing all disasters. So as Rome crumbles, slow decline over years and years and years and years, increasingly the Christians were blamed for everything, anything. It could be political, it could be financial, it could be natural disaster. It didn't matter. It was always the Christians' fault. And this was a common theme. In fact, Tertullian, we talked about him last time. Tertullian, writing around 200 A.D., he wrote about this. He said, "If the Tiber rises as high as the city walls, and if the Nile does not rise to the fields, if the weather will not change, if there is an earthquake, a famine, or a plague, straightway the cry is heard, 'Toss the Christian to the lion.'" So there are all kinds of accusations made against Christians that led to persecution. But I think even though we can look at those individually and see a lot of them are just gross misrepresentations of Christians, The real reason why Christians were persecuted, of course, is because they were Christians, because they bore the name of Christ. Peter wrote about this in 1 Peter 4, where he said, "But if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in having that name." So I think that tells us right there, all throughout church history, Christians have battled spiritual warfare. And at times that crops up as physical warfare as well, physical suffering, physical persecution. And we certainly see plenty of instances in the early church of that. You know, Perpetua, she would get these visits from her father. And this was really a touching comment in her diary, where her father, trying to convince her to recant of her faith, finally Perpetua tried to put it this way. She said to her father, she says, "Father, do you see this vessel, this water pot over here? Can it be called by any other name than what it is?" And when her father agreed it could not, she continued and she said, "So also can I not call myself by any other name than what I am, a Christian." She'd say, "Look, this is who I am. This is my identity. You can't change that." Peter also wrote in 1 Peter, "Rejoice as you share in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may also rejoice with great joy when his glory is revealed. If you are ridiculed for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you." And I'll end here today with this this excerpt from a letter from either the second or the third century. We're not real sure. But it's a letter called The Address to Diognetus. And it's a wonderful description of the nature of Christians, how they lived in the early church. The letter says this in part. It says, "Christians are no different from the rest of their nationality, language, or customs. They live in their own countries, but as sojourners. They fulfill all their duties as citizens, but they suffer as foreigners. They find their homeland wherever they are, but their homeland is not in any one place. They are in the flesh, but they do not live according to the flesh. They live on earth, but are citizens of heaven. They obey all laws, but they live at a level higher than that the law requires. They love all, but all persecute them." And I'll finish right there.